Hey there, thanks for coming. Take a seat.
It's time to retire to the drawing room.
We've come a long way in Australia in regards to the treatment of mental illness. That's not to say that all is perfect, but it's better than it was a couple of decades ago. Professor Katie Holmes has been researching the history of mental illness in Australia, and she joins me now along with Mark Fennane, historian and criminologist. Welcome to both of you. So what sets your research apart from previous explorations into the history of mental illness, Katie?
So this research was part of a large oral history project called Australian Generations, which we did with the National Library of Australia and ABC Social History Unit. We were talking to people about their life histories, their life stories, and we interviewed about 300 people across Australia. One of the really striking things to emerge within those interviews was how many people talked about their experience of mental illness, either their own or that of a parent or sibling. This was in really striking contrast to an oral history project that was done for the Bicentenary, when very few people talked there about their experience of mental illness. And so one of the things that interested me was what's changed in the period since that study was done in the early 1980s and now. And what did that tell us about the different understandings of mental illness and how it's being treated?
So you didn't initially go looking for people with a mental illness to research. They just kind of emerged.
Yes, and I think that was one of the really interesting things about the project, was that the people that we talked to who had some experience of mental illness didn't feel defined by that experience, and they didn't define themselves by it either, or some may have, but was part of their life history, part of their life story. So it wasn't something that they necessarily felt that they had to tell. It emerged often just in the context of talking about their life.
Mark, how interested have historians been in mental illness?
Well, increasingly so over the last 20 years or so, Patricia. Myself, I started working about 40 years ago on the area, but increasingly, particularly with deinstitutionalisation and the changing debates around mental illness and the rights of the mentally ill, there's been a lot more interest shown in it. I think what's different about the research that Katie's publishing is that it highlights the experience of those around the mentally ill as well as the mentally ill themselves, you know, the children and families of the mentally ill. Much of the historical work on mental illness has been focused very much on the institutional histories and to some extent on the experience of people within them. But yeah, it's become quite a solid area of social history over the last 20 years.
Katie, that intergenerational element that Mark has effectively talked about, the relationship that we have to people with mental illness, the effect it has on children, to the other people in someone's life. Is that part of what you looked at, and what did you find?
Yes, that was one of the really striking things to emerge, is how many people talked about their childhood experiences of, say, for example, primarily a parent who had some sort of mental illness, often undiagnosed, or treated with Valium, for example, you know, a mother who might be depressed and treated with Valium but never having had a diagnosis. The ongoing impact of that experience in their own life, particularly if that person went on then to have some experience of mental illness themselves. So one of the things that emerged was this intergenerational experience, which often was very powerful and I think has been more hidden in terms of the way in which we talk about mental illness. We don't often think about those, as Mark says, who are surrounding the mentally ill and the impact of that on them.
I imagine that for people who've grown up around mental illness, that penny drops later in life, the realisation that the family mental illness has had such an impact on their life.
Yes, I think it usually is something that they come to later. I think as children, you know, what is your normal is your family, and you may slowly start to understand that, well, your family is slightly different, or you may feel that you don't want to bring friends home because when you bring friends home, things get really uncomfortable and dad might be off his tree or mum might be acting really strangely. So children manage those things often themselves and often discreetly and quietly and not really understanding what is going on. We know now that there can be huge amounts of fear associated and isolation associated with those experiences for children. But then slowly as they become older, yes, they then start to think, my goodness me, that was what was going on with my mother. And one of the women that I talk about in the research that I've recently published, she could trace her grandmother's experience of depression, her mother's experience of depression, and then her own experience of depression, and see that, you know, intergenerational experience as being a very powerful narrative in her family.
Mark, back to the legal responses. You've summarised the legal treatment of the mentally ill in three phases. What are those phases?
Well, in the 19th century, mental illness from about the 1840s in particular was associated with dangerousness. And in fact, the first Lunacy Act in New South Wales from the 1840s is called the Dangerous Lunatics Act. That gave way towards the end of the 19th century to other legislation that was more focused on a notion of custodial care, which dominated the approach down to about the 1980s, by which time deinstitutionalisation had effectively begun. And I think in since the 1980s, with the establishment of mental health tribunals, there's been a different approach towards recognising that the rights of mentally ill people have to be protected at the same time as care for them is guaranteed and provided. All this is very ideal, of course. The way in which all this works in practice on the ground, it can be very different.
So, Mark, are the laws now adequate? The thing with a big social issue like this is that it constantly is evolving. The research is evolving. The science around it is evolving. People's experience and language around it is evolving. Do you feel like the current framework is best practice?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, these things evolve. There's a good deal of concern, I think, about the continuing use of effectively compulsory detention orders in some jurisdictions. In spite of the change in legislation, there's still a large number of people who have to be confined by force. There's a bit of a gap between the assertion of the rights of the mentally ill and the way in which our laws operate to put in safe custody people who are seen as threatening others or themselves.
On RN, you're in the drawing room, and my guests are Mark Fineen, Professor of History at Griffith University and the member of the Griffith Criminology Institute, and also Katie Holmes, Professor of History at La Trobe University. Mark and Katie, I'd like to get both of your perspectives on this, but perhaps I'll start with you, Katie. Historically, there's been a community indifference to the well-being of people with mental illness. It's a broad statement, but I mean, you know, people are not highly invested in high-level cases particularly. Do you think much has really changed in that regards? We're talking about it, sure, about depression, for instance, a sort of mainstream version of mental illness, but are we any more comfortable with people who are really dealing with profound mental illness?
Short answer to that, I would say, is no. I think that we have become very comfortable at talking about certain aspects of mental illness, and depression is one of them, or anxiety, for example. But we are still very uncomfortable talking about and dealing with, for example, schizophrenia or, you know, serious psychosis. Many people still feel great shame around those particular types of mental illness. We actually did have a number of about two people in our project who had schizophrenia, who talked quite openly about it. They both, interestingly, felt that their experience had changed significantly in that it was much more acceptable now to talk about it. At the same time, they wanted to go on the record to say that there's still a great deal of misunderstanding about the condition, and part of their reason for actually volunteering for interview in both those cases was to try and kind of raise awareness and set the record straight about them and their lives and their capacity to carry on fairly functional, you know, normal lives. But my feeling in general is that we still really shy away from dealing with the more extreme forms of mental illness.
Mark, do you think we're better at talking about the issues that Katie's just outlined there, people who are dealing with schizophrenia or psychosis? Has that shifted?
Yes, look, I agree that we're better at talking about it. There are many ways in which the public media has been much more responsive to addressing the issues of mental illness quite openly and to giving a voice to mentally ill people. It's not uncommon now to see talkback radio and TV with people suffering various stages of mental illness being allowed their voice, and that's very different to what the situation was 50 years ago. Here in Brisbane, I conducted a long-term project on the history of Wollstone Park Hospital, which went back 140 years, and we had an exhibition on that hospital in 2007, and we had 60,000 visitors over 3 months go through that exhibition. There's an enormous amount of interest, but still a lot of misunderstanding and a real problem in institutional design to cope with serious mental illness, as Katie was referring to.
And Katie, you've found that the key drivers are gender, poverty and inequality. Can you explain this? I mean, you're not saying that mental illness leads to crime, are you, or that there is a cause and effect here?
I think what I'm saying is that often we assume that these, you know, the experience of mental illness occurs irrespective of social status or our gender. And in fact, both historically and contemporarily, what we see is that there are key kind of indicators around mental illness, and that this is a social condition. It's not just something that's genetic either. So that if you are powerless, if you are desperately poor, if you are in abusive relationships, you are more likely to suffer some form of mental illness than if you haven't got those kind of circumstances behind you. So that's what I mean by some of the drivers of inequality, as it were.
So ultimately then, policy and the way that policy is rolled out, you know, federally at a state level, can have a direct reduction in the potential of people having mental illnesses, if you're going to sort of take that to its logical extension.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that is quite important about this research, is that when you think about the potential for intergenerational mental illness, and the way in which people who have been exposed to that as children, if they haven't got the support, if their parents haven't got the support that is necessary, then they themselves are more likely to go on and experience mental illness. Now, some people might want to put that down to genetics. I actually think genetics might be one aspect of it, but I think we have to look at the social conditions as well. That's where those issues around inequality and the kind of support that we can provide. So if, for example, you can provide refuge for women who are in violent relationships and their children, then you are making a long-term investment in the mental health of the children of that relationship and the woman herself, or man, whatever the situation is. So it does have an impact on social policy, and it's a really important one, I think.
Absolutely. Mark, in regards to attitudes and the way we talk about mental illness that we just were talking about there, you mentioned media reporting and the response and the role, really the key role of the media. I mean, yes. Even here at the ABC, we've obviously run the Mental As campaign, which has been crucial. It's interesting, though, in the media, particularly in reporting crime, mental illness is often mentioned still. We'll never read that a sort of perfectly sane person has committed a crime, but we'll often read that someone with schizophrenia, for example, has committed a crime. I wonder what your reflections are on the way we do that, Mark.
Well, I think it's, to a degree, it's a reflection of a continuing prejudice around the links between mental illness and antisocial and even criminal behaviour, which is belied by the reality that many very mentally well people do commit crime. On the other hand, we do know that, and it's been recognised now for two or three decades, how serious the mental health problems of people who do get arrested and convicted and are present in our jails. This is a very widespread problem in all Australian jurisdictions. So we can't deny the reality that many of those who have committed crime in fact have a range of mental illness and other related disorders, for example, learning difficulties, issues like this that have placed people at risk of offending and antisocial behaviour.
Katie, we were talking off-air before about my own reflection, and I said to you, is it true that we're just more depressed now, or, you know, could that possibly be the case? How can we be more depressed? Are we more depressed, or are we just talking about it more?
Well, I certainly think we're talking about it more. That's one of the things that has changed really significantly in the last 30 years, for example. We have a language and an understanding about suffering and are more willing to talk about emotions and our emotional life than we were previously. I don't know that that means we're more depressed. I certainly think that, again, there's serious social conditions that have changed such that the pressures and expectations on people as a result of high pressure, fast-paced lifestyle and all the stresses and tensions that brings can themselves be indicators for risk of mental illness. But there was a great deal of sadness and depression and illness in the past as well. And if you look at, for example, the experience of what we now identify as post-traumatic stress disorder amongst, for example, World War I veterans, we would see that there would have been widespread mental illness in that cohort. It's just that we didn't have a name for it, or we called it shell shock, and it was hidden.
So it's a case that we're also now really reporting it more. So we were repressing it in the past.
Yes, I think there's a lot to that.
I want to thank you both for coming in and having this chat. It's been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Patricia.
Thanks very much,
Patricia. And that's Katie Holmes. She's a Professor of History at the La Trobe University, and also Mark Finane, Professor of History at Griffith University and a member of the Griffith Criminology Institute.